This podcast series is brought to you from the University of Winchester. We invite you to listen in as we talk with both academics and practitioners about their approaches to peace building and conflict transformation, discussing some of the most complex and pressing challenges we face in the world today.
I'm Anna King and Professor of Religious Studies and Social Anthropology at the University of Winchester. Today, my guest is Professor Hugh Mile, Emeritus Professor of International Relations at the University of Kent and Chair of the Conflict Research Society. His main research area is in conflict research and conflict resolution, and he's the author of many books and articles that have become seminal texts within the field of peace studies. He's a trained mediator and has co-facilitated several peace-building workshops. I personally last met Hugh a year or so ago in Lumbini, the birthplace of the Buddha in Nepal, and I'm very much looking forward to our discussion. Hugh, could we find out something about your early life and education? I think our listeners will be intrigued to know how they led you to the field of peace studies.
Well, thank you for having me, Anna, and thank you for that kind introduction. I was born in 1949. I was the eldest in a large family, and we had a happy childhood in South Wales and in Jamaica. My father was a Quaker, and he'd been a conscientious objector, a conscientious objector at the start of the World War. He joined the Friends Ambulance Unit. He didn't previously have any medical qualifications, although he trained as a doctor after the war. And he served as an ambulance man, bringing people back from the front lines in Finland and Norway. And then he went on a big journey all the way through Russia and Turkey and served again in Egypt and then in Greece. And then he was captured and spent the rest of the war in a prisoner of war camp in Greece. My mother was a teacher, but she also became a Quaker later in life. And they sent me to a Quaker boarding school when we were living in Jamaica. And so I suppose I got, brought up in the, or indoctrinated, if you like, in the Quaker witness to peace and war. I was in the school in the 60s. One of the things I particularly remember was when I was 13, the Cuban Missile Crisis had a big effect on everybody who can remember it. And I remember after that editing an issue of the school magazine about Hiroshima and nuclear weapons and the dangers that they posed to us. When I was still quite young, we went on camping holidays in Europe, and I remember on one of them we went through the battlefields of Flanders, and I remember the impact that visiting those sites had had me. So I think I was always kind of aware of the presence and the threat of war in the background. Mm. And I think sort of really by coincidence, I happened to come across some of the leading figures in peace studies at quite an early age. My father had met through his medical research the adopted son, Stephen Richardson, of Lewis Richardson, who is the famous Quaker meteorologist and one of the real founders of peace studies. And Stephen Richardson gave us copies of Lewis Richardson's two great books, The Statistics of Deadly Quarrels and Arms and Insecurity. So I remember kind of reading them, trying to understand them, getting fascinated by this new approach to the study of peace and war. And I think we also met Kenneth and Elise Boulding, who were on sabbatical in Jamaica for a year. And of course, those are also both founding figures of field of peace and conflict studies. And I read quite early on Kenneth Boulding's book, Conflict and Defence, and that had quite a big impact on me. I then read modern history at Oxford, and had a very traditional training in history. You know, we were expected to learn everything in English history from Julius Caesar to 1939, when history stops. I remember going to some seminars organized by Michael Howard, the Regius Professor of Modern History, who was also a leading light in war studies.
Mm.
And he organized a seminar on the problems of Eastern war in the nuclear age. And although I was only an undergraduate, kind of sitting in on a postgraduate seminar, he asked me to do a paper about the behavioralists and the kind of peace studies approach. So I gave a contribution to that seminar. Afterwards, I asked him where you could do further study in the peace and conflict field. And he told me about various places in Britain, but there weren't many at the time. And one of them was the Richardson Institute for Peace Studies in Lancaster University. And I got the information about it, and it looked attractive, and ended up going for a PhD there. And then I was very influenced, I think, by my supervisor there, who was a former physicist called Paul Smoker, who'd been a London organizer for CND. And then with others, he set up the very first peace and conflict research center in England, which was set up in Lancaster in 1957. And so when I was there, there were about seven or eight PhD students and perhaps two or three members of staff. But Paul was very inspiring. He had very long hair, very colourful clothes. He lived on a small holding, and he kept pigs and bees and goats and students. And I wrote my PhD in his greenhouse. When I was doing my PhD, I had a chance to go to some of the early peace research conferences. I heard Johan Galtung. I met some of the leading peace and conflict research figures at the time. So I suppose that really inspired me to try to contribute to this field. And I've always been intrigued by it and convinced of its importance since then.
Thank you. That's really fascinating. And it gives a wonderful background to what we're going to talk about now. So one of the things I've noticed in reading your work is that you've always had a very global interest in and perspective on the conditions of peace and war. In your view, how could the ways in which the international system is now organized be improved to avoid violent conflict? So if you could talk about that would be wonderful.
Yes. If you study history, it's very obvious that the way the international system is organized, has a huge impact on war and peace. I think one of the things that I learned when reading history was how important nations and nationalism were in the history of European warfare. And it's not been a linear story of either increase in war or decrease in war, but a kind of alternation between periods of relative order, relative peace, although never really a true peace, but periods in which nations organized themselves, somewhat for better, like in the Concert of Europe, or in the period when the League of Nations was there, in the period when the early UN was there, when there's been a kind of periods of cooperation between states, there's been less warfare. And of course that's alternated with periods where states have violently competed, and we've had these terrible wars and total wars. Karl Deutsch, who's one of the leading figures in international relations and conflict studies, came up with the idea of a security community, which is the idea of a society of states which have lost the fear of fighting with one another. And I think at some periods in history, some groups of states have got to been able to build a kind of security community. And the states have kind of developed a stable expectation of peaceful change. And I think that in communities of any size, that's what we need. We need a kind of, you know, if in the in very atomized and fragmented societies, you tend to get rival power centers and people struggling for power, and then, you know, everybody feels insecure. But when you can build a society with, you know, you've now institutionalized a sense of stability and a sense of order, then you can build some kind of security. And it doesn't have to be only at the international level. It can happen at the community level. So I think we see kind of small-scale zones of peace alongside zones of war, if you like. And so the study of, I think, peace studies is about what we can do to develop and increase those zones of peace and restrain the zones of war. So, I mean, all of that led me into an interest in conflict resolution, conflict transformation, which asked very similar questions about how we can manage conflict. But I always thought that conflict resolution is linked to the wider question of context, you know, what kind of institutions, what kind of groups do we work in and manage ourselves in those groups. You know, conflict itself isn't bad. Indeed, conflict is necessary and, you know, a positive thing that sometimes when it's needed to bring about change when conditions are unjust or when power relations are asymmetric and unbalanced. But violent conflict is a deadly threat to human survival.
One of the greatest threats to human security is, of course, climate change. And I wonder if conflict resolution has anything to say about climate change.
Yes. Well, personally, I believe that conflict resolution can be applied to conflicts at any level. It's often not, of course, and it requires, you know, it requires openness to it by the participants in the conflict. I mean, at the smallest scale of, you know, of disputes between individuals, I trained as a mediator with Lambeth, Mediation Service, you know, I've been able to see and witness how you can actually resolve neighborhood disputes sometimes in a single evening, you know, just by getting people around the table and really going through the issues with them. And, you know, people don't want to be in conflict, and they're often, you know, if they can find a way out, then they're often very pleased. And then at the largest end of the scale, we've got, you know, structural conflicts in the global economic, and climate change, I think, fits into that large end. It's a struggle, you know, between and within the richer and poorer countries about who's going to bear responsibility for mitigating and adapting to the climate change, who's going to pay for the measures that we need, how we're going to wean ourselves away from the fossil fuel industries and replace them with sustainable forms. And we sort of know how to do it all. It's just a question of bringing it forward and coping with the entrenched interests and, you know, which interests which are built up around the profit people have made from fossil fuels and related industries. So it is possible to change people's behaviour. We talk about the tragedy of the commons, and, you know, people think that there's a kind of inevitability to the fact that if you've got a common resource, like in this case, the atmosphere, and the pollution then inevitably gets polluted. But I think people forget that actually in medieval England, for example, people were quite good at managing the commons. There used to be, you know, agreements and conventions about how many cows each family could put out on the commons. And actually people did manage to pasture their cows in a kind of amicable way. And there are all sorts of different rules. I have a colleague at Lancaster who looked into the history of all this. And Eleanor Ostrom has written some very good books about the management of natural resources, which really shows how conflict resolution has been applied to environmental issues. For example, you know, looking at communities of fishers managing limited fish by, you know, agreeing on who's going to fish in which particular area at particular times, or Californian water companies, for example, managing, you know, water in areas of scarcity by agreeing on rates of drawdown and so on. So there's a whole kind of subfield of conflict resolution which is about environmental conflict resolution. It is, in a way, you know, I think like much of conflict transformation, it's a mixture of negotiating things and also in some respects prosecuting conflict, because, you know, the fossil fuel industries do have to be got rid of quite quickly. And that's going to be, you know, it's going to be painful for some people who've been profiting from it, but, you know, the collective interest in making this rapid transition.
That's a very interesting long view, and it's fascinating. Thank you. As you know, our centre is focused very much on religion and peace building and conflict transformation. And I know from some of your articles that you're interested in religion, religious organisations, religious actors. Could we consider whether you think that religion is primarily a source of conflict or of peace? You know that Appleby refers to this ambivalence of religion. I wonder what your ideas are on about it.
Yes. Well, I think it's an important field of inquiry, and I'm delighted that, you know, that you and your colleagues at Winchester and the students there are studying it, and I think it's a really valuable field of study. I think there's no doubt that religious identity conflicts have been a really big source of conflict in history, and they still are a big issue in civil wars and in international relations today. Monica Toft wrote a study arguing that religious identity conflicts account for more than half of the civil wars, in that civil wars involve groups which are demarcated by different religious identities, or in some cases the conflicts are actually about issues that have to do with religion. Although I think often it's more a matter of people following different religious persuasions coming into conflict about issues which aren't particularly religious. I mean, you might say it's, you know, whose fault are all the religious wars? Was it Muhammad's and Christ's, or was it the Muslims and the Christians? I mean, I think that it's equally clear that, you know, religion has been very important, both in helping to end conflict sometimes and in trying to develop ways of building peace, also in actually framing and in kind of conceptualizing or in inventing our ideas of what peace means. And some of the major meanings of peace are really associated with religious sources. And, I mean, for example, Islam in Arabic is very close to the idea of salam, and, you know, it carries the idea of inner peace linked to social cohesion and justice in the community. In the Quaker tradition, you know, the gathered meeting for worship is an example of a community manifesting inner peace in a collective way, and it's reflected in the outer peace work that Quakers do. And I think the Buddhist tradition too, although it's not religious in the sense that, you know, there's no sense of a god in Buddhism, but there's a sense of interbeing or interconnectedness, or a feeling that everything inter is with everything else, and or the, in some sense that we're all part of a whole. And so I think that these religious traditions are very different, but in some ways they all seem to be getting the same sort of thing in some respects. certainly some of the religious communities have made very valuable and impressive contributions to peace building. I mean, I think of the, you know, the work of the Sant'Egidio community in the Catholic tradition, or, you know, the engaged Buddhists, and Thich Nhat Hanh's work trying to end the Vietnam War, you know, what the Quakers do. I think religious sources of peace building can make an enormous contribution. In very good work done in your centre about the ways in which religious peace building has been done in places like Sri Lanka and elsewhere. So, yeah.
So, actually, I think you may have answered my next question, which was going to be deceptively simple, which is, what do we mean by peace? And I don't know whether you've covered that, but I'd be very interested to know what you think.
Yes, well, I mean, I think it's a vital question for peace studies, of course, because it's in peace and conflict studies, but it's crucial. And so many people have different understandings of what peace is. And I think, in a way, our culture is, you know, has got different views. And a student of mine once carried out a fascinating study, a survey of peace builders in a network called the Global Conflict Prevention Network. And it was amazing how many different conceptions of peace people had, even though they were engaged in very similar kinds of peace building activities. But in a way, you could see all these different conceptions as, you know, perhaps like a bit of the elephant that different blind people were touching and trying to see the whole thing from. There was a sense in which their different senses all kind of made something of a larger whole. I think the most common sense of peace is just the absence of war. Mm-hmm. And it's not to be sniffed at, you know, if you're a Syrian, the absence of war is absolutely what you're craving for. But of course, absence of war doesn't mean justice, or it doesn't mean absence of the conditions which could lead to wars, or it doesn't mean absence of coercion and so on. Many people think of peace as involving something positive as well, which could be, you know, equality or justice or a sense of order or harmony or collaboration and coordination between people. And then there's cultural peace in the sense of respecting people from different traditions. And then there's Gaia peace in terms of, you know, balance with our natural environment, and gender peace, and then inner peace to go with all of those. And then, I personally find the Buddhist idea of wholeness of, you know, it kind of helped for me. It wrapped up all these other senses of peace, and it gives a sense that, you know, we are ultimately part of a bigger whole. And so if we can act in accordance with that recognition, then we're more likely to act peacefully. And very much like some of the work of John McConnell, who wrote that great book on mindful mediation about the Buddhist tradition of mediation and what its connections are to meditation. And he talks about the Buddhist doctrine of Kusalamula, you know, the idea of greed and illusion and hatred, the kind of three poisons. And it's quite close to Johann Belton's idea that conflict is a conflict of goals and of hostile feelings and destructive behavior. And so I think if you see the opposite of those, that peace is a harmony of goals, and peace is mutual respect, or building mutual respect, and creation of warm and, you know, cooperative relationships, and that kind of gives you a sense of what peace can be. And peace building is then the practice of trying to work on and bring about change in that direction. And I think in our own particular fields, to take that forward.
So we're coming almost to the end, which is very sad because I've been fascinated, but I must ask you about this. You describe yourself as a long-term optimist, and Steven Pinker, as you know, says that life has been getting better for most people. He argues that the Enlightenment values of reason, science, humanism have brought progress and that health, prosperity, safety, peace and happiness have tended to rise worldwide. I mean, I've been thinking about the news, about Trump, about all sorts of international conflicts. Do you agree with Pinker's argument? And a final enormous question, how do you see humanity's future?
Yes, well...
and we've only got 5 minutes.
5 minutes, right. Well, I describe myself as a long-term optimist and a short-term pessimist. So perhaps we both fit into that category. I mean, I do think that some of the forces that Pinker points to are associated with long-term progress and, you know, education, science, you know, better understanding. I think Pinker does admit that progress can be suddenly interrupted. You know, for example, if we were to suffer something like a nuclear war, that the trends that he points to could go into reverse. And in the short term, the bulletin of the atomic scientists have got their clock at 1 minute to midnight, and we can't take any comfort from, you know, the situation of the world on the nuclear front. Pinker argues that there's a long-term trend towards a decline in violence. In, you know, his book, Better Angels of Our Nature, brings forward a lot of evidence, slightly selectively, to try to buttress that claim. I think what he actually demonstrates is a decline in violence per capita. I think that's overwhelming evidence that that is the case. But if you look at it without factoring in the rise in population that we've had, I think the total sum of violence actually fluctuates up and down without any very clear trend. As I said before, it's, you know, some periods, some centuries have more and some have less. And I think it's actually hard to demonstrate either an increase or a decrease. But I think he is right, though, to say that we do have better angels of our nature, and that there are factors like empathy and mutual understanding which, you know, can bring about progress. And I think that just as there are correlates of war or causes of war, so there are correlates of peace, and that, you know, one can think of the other things besides things at an individual level, like, you know, better governance, economic order and equality between groups, gender equality, which, you know, are demonstrably associated with the peaceful conditions. So we do know things about the conditions of peace as well as about the conditions of war. And so I think, you know, humanity is a bit like an individual person. I mean, we have most of us as individuals have a hopefully reasonably happy and reasonably fulfilling life, and we hope that humanity will have the same. But, you know, unfortunately, some of us commit suicide or get killed or come to a sticky end in one way or another, and the same could happen to humanity. And there is nothing, you know, you can't really predict the future from what's happened in the past. It's dependent on what we do now. All we can do is to kind of, in a way, plant seeds of positive change and nourish seeds that others have planted. And Michael Howard, the Oxford professor of history, said that making peace is a bit like gardening. You know, it's about kind of tending the good shoots and taking away the weeds. It's a never-ending job, but it can yield, you know, fruitful and heartwarming results. And, I think that's right.
Well, thank you very much for those very wise words. I've very much enjoyed our talk, and Hugh, thank you so much. And I hope we meet again very, very soon. So thank you so much on behalf of the university and particularly our centre. Thank you.
Thank you very much too, Anna. I very much enjoyed it. Thank you.